This public radio podcast is supported by Double Take Gallery, now showing works by Salvador Dali, Norman Rockwell, and many local artists, located in the Southern Lights Building in Burnsville, and online at doubletakegallery.com.
This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, the message and the messenger to Black America. Bill Cosby plays the Performing Arts Center in Tulsa next weekend, but there's a pretty good chance he won't be telling that audience what he told the people in the pews of a Detroit church last summer. Journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates was sitting in the audience, having finagled his way into a speech that was closed to the press, when Cosby reprised the tone and tenor of a controversial talk he gave in 2004. That night, Cosby was speaking at an NAACP gathering, and he let it rip.
The Board of Education is no longer the white person's problem. We've got to take the neighborhood back. We've got to go in there. It's right around the corner. It's standing on the corner. It can't speak English. It doesn't want to speak English. I can't even talk the way these people talk. Why you ain't where you is? Go wild back. I don't know who these people are, and I blamed the kid until I heard the mother talk. And then I heard the father talk. This is all in the house. Everybody knows it's important to speak English, except these knuckleheads. You can't land a plane with why you ain't where. You can't be a doctor with that kind of crap coming out of your mouth.
Since then, Bill Cosby has been performing his comedy act in some venues and his self-described call-outs in others. But it's the call-outs, of course, that are attracting the most scrutiny. And that's what Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote about in the May issue of Atlantic Monthly. He notes that while Cosby built a career in television making race largely inconspicuous, he's now become a full-throated social critic about Black America, earning disdain from some quarters and plaudits from others. And he notes in the article that Cosby's message is getting a fresh look as Senator Barack Obama talks about race and responsibility in his own way throughout the campaign. Today, Ta-Nehisi Coates joins us as we examine just what Cosby's tough love message really means and how it plays in both white and Black America. Mr. Coates is a correspondent for Atlantic Monthly. His article is titled, "This is How We Lost to the White Man, The Audacity of Bill Cosby's Black Conservatism." His new memoir, Beautiful Struggle, comes out on Tuesday, and he joins us from New York City. Good to have you with us this morning. Thanks for spending the hour with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Later in the hour, John McWhorter is going to join us as well. He's a fellow with the Manhattan Institute, and he's author of the book Winning the Race. I thought it was interesting that you label what Cosby has been going around to, we should say, standing room only crowds in a lot of cases, and talking about. And I wonder if you mean that conservative in the political sense or in some other sense?
No, certainly not in the political sense. As I say in the piece, there's a very specific Black conservative tradition that in some ways shares some things that are in common with the way we understand conservatism in the broader sort of body politic, this sort of idea of individual responsibility. But in other ways, it's radically different. I think that one of the differences Black conservatives, in different cases, but traditionally Black conservatives or organic Black conservatives have often at the same time maintained a critique of the larger country, even as they, act for individual responsibility amongst their own.
So how would you, when we're talking about this in the African-American community, what do we mean specifically when we say conservative?
We mean people who think that raising their kids is the most important thing, who don't necessarily believe that the government is responsible for the fate of their neighborhood or their children, who don't necessarily put the right to choose or gay marriage at the top of their, list of priorities. People who are, mostly concerned with, as I said, individual responsibility. And don't sit around, as Cosby said, blaming the white man. And I have to say, I think, and I say this, as probably a guy who's pretty far to the left, I think a large number of black people fall within that category.
Who could be described as conservative?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. That's kind of reductive. But in that sense, yes. In the sense that I think the broader country could be described as traditional and conservative.
You know what? What's interesting about this, Ta-Nehisi? You can, that speech in 04, which is known as the pound cake speech, and we're going to explain why here in just a moment, stirred up a lot of controversy, and Cosby basically took it on the road from there. In that first night from the NAACP Awards, you can hear people laughing and cheering, but I also understand that people walked out.
Yeah, some people walked out. I think, you know, there are two parts to this. And the first part is a lot of people, you know, in their heart of hearts, a large percentage of black folks, I think, shared the anger, the sense of disappointment, the belief that, you know, black people should be further along. Every time there's some sort of study of socioeconomic statistics coming out, black folks are at the bottom. And there is a great, great degree of shame in the African-American community about that. And I think that goes across the board. And to the extent that Cosby has proven to be extremely popular among African-Americans, I think he's tapping into that. And I think that's very real. At the same time, I think, as you just played in your clip, some of the demeaning language that he used to describe especially poor people, to describe young people, I think a lot of, you know, other folks don't necessarily feel is necessarily helpful.
Now, is it fair to say that this is getting, it's getting a fresh look because, A, Cosby is still traveling around the country and giving speeches like this, but also because there's a contrast between what he's saying in these halls and these churches and what Barack Obama is saying on the campaign trail? Tell me how you would describe the contrast.
I don't know how much of a contrast there is. I think, you know, one of the things that Barack Obama does that he's figured out is that you can, you know, and as I put it in the piece, you can basically do a racial double play, because you can go in front of black audiences and you can say, you know, you guys need to be responsible for your kids, you need to do this, you need to do that, and you can get a lot of cheers for saying that. And at the same time, that sort of clip will be played on TV, and white people will say, well, finally somebody's telling black people that they need to go, you know, take care of their kids. I think there's a broad misapprehension among a lot of people that, you know, black folks wake up in the morning and say, you know, GD the white man. If it wasn't for the white man, I'd have X, Y, and Z. But in fact, you know, I think, and I say this, you know, living in the heart of Harlem, you know, you talk to folks on the street, their concerns are very much the same concerns as you would, you know, find if you were out in Scranton, Pennsylvania. If you ask them about the neighborhood, you know, they share a lot of the frustrations that I think Barack Obama puts forth, that Cosby has, you know, also put forth. And I'll just, you know, as just to sort of explain this as an example, I'll just tell you a very quick anecdote. I was watching Hardball a couple months ago, and this was in the midst of the Texas primary.
Right.
And Chris Matthews was showing a shot of Barack Obama in a church, and, you know, Barack Obama is, you know, talking about school reform, and he says, you know, none of this stuff will matter if we don't take care of our kids, if you don't buy a desk for your kids, if you don't make sure your kids do their homework, put them to bed at a good hour. And everybody in the church is cheering, and then it goes off, and then, you know, Chris Matthews comes on and says, well, who do you think he was talking to? It sounded like to me he was talking to conservative suburban whites. And I'm watching and think, no, he's talking to the people in the church that are standing up cheering.
Yeah, and yet, though, Ta-Nehisi, the way Barack Obama talks about this is, the tone, I think, is really different. There is no, and maybe, well, I'm curious about your thoughts about it. There's no mocking, there's no, right. You know, satirical kind of sarcasm that Cosby gets laughs for, but people also kind of cringe a little bit, I guess, about some of the truth of it.
Well, there is some mocking, I'll say. If you watch it, there's some. But I think what you're getting at is, what is missing is anger.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Cosby, I think, and in fairness to him, if you sit there and watch the entire call out, it actually isn't that angry. But if you read about it in the paper, somehow how it comes across, you know, on paper, that doesn't, you know, the anger is what you get. You know what I mean? And I really hope that, you know, one of the things I did in the piece, I really hope that I contextualize that. Because I think, in all fairness to him, if you watch the whole thing, he's actually quite funny. And it actually isn't as angry as you might would think, expect it to be. Now, that speech in particular, that pound cake speech, was especially angry, but he's changed since then. You know, he's made some adjustments. I haven't heard him, you know, saying stuff like blaming, you know, sort of poor people for the condition of African-Americans. I haven't heard him mocking, you know, what people name their kids. So he's kind of cut some of that stuff out. So he's changed a little bit since 2004.
Let me give our audience another sense of some of what Cosby was saying in 04 and what you've said about the, kind of his evolution and the way he's talking about this. Again, this is at an NAACP award ceremony in Washington, D.C. in 2004, and it's come to be known as the pound cake speech, and here's why.
These are not political criminals. These are people going around stealing Coca-Cola. People getting shot in the back of the head over a piece of pound cake. And then we all run out and we're outraged. Oh, the cops shouldn't have shot him. What the hell was he doing with the pound cake in his hand?
We should say that the audio is bad because I think there were not reporters allowed to record that speech, and so a bootleg copy was made of that. You say he's not saying those kinds of things as often.
Well, he's saying those guys, which you just played, he's saying that.
He's saying the pound cake and the Coca-Cola.
He's not saying that exact joke, but it's funny. It's known as the pound cake speech because, you know, again, you know, I'm going to be very clear. You know, I'm a far left guy. But I'm going to tell you, when I heard that, that struck a chord with me.
And why?
Well, because all of us, you know, I mean, for all of, you know, our politics and for all of our, you know, deep-seated belief that, you know, there are racial problems in America that, you know, government needs to address, you know, every once in a while, you know, and the example I used, you know, when I was talking to The Atlantic was when the young girl was gunned down in North Carolina. She's a student, I want to say, the University of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she was shot, you know, robbed at a ATM. And the whole time in the back of your head, you're thinking, oh, my God, this, you know, you're looking at the crime and you're thinking, this is probably somebody black. And you're desperately hoping that it's not. And then, you know, of course, when the guy's caught, he's black. And I think collectively there is a deep-seated embarrassment over stuff like that, that no matter what somebody has done to you, no matter how biased the system is, you know, this is the game field. This is the field that we chose to play on. And once you choose to play on that field, you know, there's certain responsibilities about how you carry yourself. And no matter what, you know, critique I have institutionally for this country, I mean, that just never goes away.
Well, then let me ask you this. Is what Bill Cosby prescribes, you know, to change exactly what you're talking about this morning, right? In the view of the community that's listening to him, in the view of the, you know, the social commentators like yourself, and John McWhorter is going to join us a bit later.
Let me say my big concern is that with what he's saying is that it not be framed in such a way that says that pits personal responsibility against institutional critique. So, you know, the big example, you know, and he dealt with this later in that same, you know, speech, and he's continued to say this, is about the war on drugs. And I know this is sort of getting amended now, thank God, but the whole crack cocaine disparity. And, you know, Cosby, in one of his pitches, you know, what he would say is, you know, well, why are we out here, you know, fighting, you know, to change the crack cocaine disparity? What do you want, equal time? Tell your kids not to sell drugs. And my thing is, yeah, tell your kids not to sell drugs, but you can't, you know, you can't at the same time condone, you know, people coming harder down on criminals because they're black. You know what I mean? Like, you can do both at the same time. You can walk and chew gum. You can say, you know, to your kids, don't sell drugs. You know what I mean? And at the same time, maintain some sort of institutional protest. I think all people do that.
Do you think the objections that still come from certain members of the community to what Cosby is saying come from people who would argue that what he's saying isn't true? Do you think it's from people who don't want to hear the message delivered like he's delivering it? Or do you think there are people who, you know, who don't think Cosby really has the kind of moral authority to be saying this?
I don't know. I got to tell you, I think, you know, and we cited in the piece, you know, Pew did a poll of black folks, you know, just to ask who had a positive impact on black people. And the two highest people were Oprah and Bill Cosby, above Barack Obama.
Huh.
So I think a large number of African Americans agree with what he's saying. You know, and I'm, you know, my politics and what I think about that aside, you know, in terms of his popularity among the broader mass, I think people just don't understand how much he's tapped into something that black folks feel.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is with us this morning. He's a correspondent for Atlantic Monthly, and he's written a very interesting article that we spotted in the May edition. It's called "This Is How We Lost to the White Man, The Audacity of Bill Cosby's Black Conservatism." We're examining some of the arguments that Bill Cosby is making, some of which come out of this appearance, and we've played you a couple excerpts from this speech in 2004 in Washington, D.C., and he's still traveling around the country and making speeches like this in churches and halls, even as he performs his comedy act in other venues. We're examining some of the arguments that he's making in what he calls these call-outs, and what the black community, some commentators, have to say about it. And I'm curious about your perspective on this as well. As you've listened to this, these excerpts, and you've listened to our conversation here a bit, what strikes you about it? Do you agree with some of what Bill Cosby is saying? Is it so much about the tone? Is it specifically about the message? Join the discussion here. 1-800-242-2828. In the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Online, minnesotapublicradio.org. Click on Send a Question to Jennifer in Minneapolis. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I think that both Bill Cosby and Barack Obama have great things to say, but I think, too, that that could apply to anybody, not just black people. I mean, it could apply to white people. It could apply to Latinos or Asians. And everybody should just listen to what they have to say and take it to heart.
And Ta-Nehisi, though, you do not hear this kind of message, though, usually from white candidates, do you?
Not toward black people. And it's
why
probably,
not? Why not?
Because they probably don't have the authority to say it. Mm-hmm. And I think, one, thing that I always say, if you can't remember, if you can't, get off of one hand when you count the last few times you sat down and had dinner with a black family, you probably should chill. So people don't have the authority to say that sort of thing. Cosby is somebody, who obviously is a black man, lived as a black man. Barack Obama is from the south side of Chicago. I mean, if you live around the people, and I think that's one of the reasons why other conservatives who have tried to, push this forth before, I mean, these are not people who, deal with African Americans on a regular basis anyway. And so you often get the impression that they're saying these things for their own benefit, not necessarily, out of any degree of concern for African Americans.
Is it true that after the 2004 speech, you wrote that Cosby was an elitist and your own dad got mad about that?
Oh, yeah.
Why was he mad?
Because, he's my dad. Because everybody isn't going to, this, shows how this goes down. Everybody isn't going to agree on everything. My father views Cosby as an extremely positive, powerful is not the word I want to say here. As a good thing for African Americans. And, my dad made the case that Cosby, fought the good fight against apartheid when a lot of other people did not. They gave money to Randall Robinson's Trans Africa, supported African American schools, gave one of the single largest donations to a historically black school at Spelman College. Cosby has always, always supported African American institutions. And, his critique was not that much different. His critique of black America was not that much different than the critique of black America that my father raised me on. It just so happens, the son gets old and he deviates a little bit.
You know what I think is interesting? You point out, though, in this piece that Cosby has not always wanted to accept this, I guess we should say, role or been interested in being a social commentator. And you quote him in a 1969 Playboy interview in which he says he doesn't spend a lot of time, trying to slip messages into his act. And he also said he didn't have time to, quote, sit around and worry whether all the black people of the world make it because of me. I have my own gig to worry about. Did you ask him about that when you sat down with him?
I did not. I did not, regrettably. I did not. I didn't get much, face-to-face time with him. I think, though, one of the things that people have to remember is that those are the words of a young man. And a young man who's just made it into Hollywood. And, people change over time. And I think one of the things that happened with Cosby is as he grew, while until recently he was not, the sort of out front, overt sort of person to be dealing with racial issues, through most of his career, he's always been supportive in the background. You know, he talked about being supportive of Jesse Jackson, Operation Breadbasket. He's always been, in the background. You can, go and talk to folks all across the civil rights community. They'll talk about how Cosby has supported them, the NAACP, NAACP Legal Defense Fund. So he has the sort of bona fides and credentials to make, these sorts of critiques, rightly or wrongly.
Let me go to the phones here to Vernon in St. Paul. Hi, you're on Mid Morning. Your question or comment for us?
Yes, how you doing?
Good.
I work in a St. Paul a community center, and I'm from Philadelphia. And originally, the reason why a lot of people don't take to, from where I come from, a lot of things that Bill Cosby said. I know your caller, your guest said that. It's he did a lot of things in the background. That's the reason why, is that he did a lot of things in the background instead of coming out to the community and doing things with that people can notice. Gave a lot of money to the temple, and there was a lot of black establishment that was establishing, establishing schools in order to educate our people.
Mm-hmm.
I like to say this last thing is that if we do not educate our people in a way that our people need to be educated, then this problem, this race problem, and how white America look at us will never, ever be resolved.
Vernon, let me follow up on something I think you said, though. You're saying that some people do not think Cosby has the authority because he wasn't front and center, in the civil rights movement, movements like that?
Yeah, it wasn't only the civil rights. That was one of the biggest issues when it was coming up. It wasn't only the civil rights movement, but it was a lot of things. A lot of people was trying to get in contact with him to come to the forefront and because of who he was. He could have helped a lot of the problem. But then to come without the education, of the black education, what's going on in our community, he come and make these statements of how we have a right to name our kids particular things, and then he makes fun of that, and he always saying in the background he hid himself from our biggest problem instead of coming to the forefront and letting America know that he... It's for the things that we stand for.
I thank you for your call.
Thanks a lot.
Ta-Nehisi, curious about what you think of that.
I think that he made a big mistake by making fun of people, what people name their kids, and by saying that poor people weren't holding up their end of the bargain. I think he turned off a lot of people who would have been very receptive to what he was saying. Now, in his defense, he thought that he was talking in private. He didn't realize there were reporters there or anything like that, and that's what he told me about that. Having said that, I just... the idea that, part of the problems that African Americans go through is because they choose to name, I can't be named Ta-Nehisi, but somebody else can be named Giuseppe. Like, that's okay. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I think that's hugely, hugely problematic and sort of beside the point.
Well, he did have that whole riff on Shaniqua, and, he goes down the list, and he's doing that in a mocking way. And you say that really, for some people, that was it. They weren't going to listen to what he had to say after that.
Yeah. I mean, and obviously that's what people are going to seize on. I mean, regrettably, I know that wasn't the entirety of what he was trying to say. And in his defense, I haven't heard him say that since then. But that, I know, and you might say, you probably could look at what I wrote immediately afterwards and look at what I wrote in The Atlantic and say, there's some difference. And I think in large measure, you have a very emotional response. I have a very emotional response. I mean, again, my name is Ta-Nehisi. My spouse's name is Kenyatta. My son's name is Samari. I mean, we all got weird names. And so, this sort of idea to link black failure to the idea that I don't want to name my kid Michael is, I think, again, while, people, from other cultures get to name their kids all, whatever they may want, that just, I think, turned a lot of people off.
800-242-2828. If you're trying to get in by phone, be patient here. We've got pretty full phone lines, and we're moving our way through these calls. I'm glad you want to join the conversation. 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, click on Send a Question. By the way, John McWhorter joining us a bit later in our discussion, a fellow with the Manhattan Institute, author of the book Winning the Race. He's also written about Bill Cosby. Online here, Ta-Nehisi, from Mark in Hastings, compare Cosby's message with Wright's, and I think he means Jeremiah Wright's, black lib theology, quote unquote. Aren't they the same? Black America has to get their own house in order. Do you see similarities between the two?
Yeah, but you know what? I'm going to plead ignorance here and say I do not know enough I think one of the unfortunate things about this Jeremiah Wright thing is, and, you know, not that he doesn't bear responsibility for acting a fool on Monday, you know, and for not being smarter about how he presented himself. I don't know enough fully of the man to really, you know, make an adequate comparison between him and Cosby. I don't know enough about black liberation theology. I worked on that Cosby story and have been thinking about it for many years now. Mm. And I just don't know enough. And I worry about, you know, sort of contributing to the caricaturing of, you know, of Reverend Wright. Again, I don't say that to excuse anything that he said or to say that I agree with anything that he said, but I think people should be considered in context, and I don't have that context.
All right, let me go back to the phones here to Robin in St. Paul. Hi, Robin. Thanks for waiting. Your question or comment for us?
Hi, thank you very much. I have to first of all say, as a person who lives and walks with people who are broken and among people that are broken, this is no laughing matter. At all, I think that we have to begin, and I think of the potential of a Mr. Cosby and others, if they could begin to mobilize people to begin to speak about how do we heal and how do we hope. It could be phenomenal. But for those of us who walk so close in with the pain, but also the possibilities, can we change the dialogue to begin to lift up the hope and the healing, especially of our children? As I sat with sixth grade African-American boys yesterday and saw their pain, but also witnessed their potential, what powerful, powerful movement it would be if Cosby and others would begin to change the dialogue to talk about collective healing. Well, it's not a laughing matter.
Robin, I want to be clear about what you're saying, though. So you hear some of what Cosby is saying and you understand and appreciate the critique. What's missing from the message, then?
I don't know to what extent I appreciate the critique when you tell broken folks how broken they are.
Okay.
Yet you're not coming with some concrete things. What he represents is folks from industries who have so much power as African Americans, as other people who want to be our allies, to begin to look at a commitment to healing, a commitment to hope among people who are broken. There's some irresponsibility there, especially when we know, and we're savvy enough to know, how media could take things out of context. We're living in that right now. And so there has to be a responsibility. But let's move beyond that and talk about, let's come together, people of different walks, and talk about how do we commit to, as Maya Angelou says, rescuing our youth and supporting the rescuers so that we can move to some serious humanity, healing, and hope.
Good to have your call. Thanks very much. We appreciate it. I'm going to take a break for news. When we come back, Ta-Nehisi Coates continues with us. John McWhorter joins us, and I'm going to ask both of them. I know John has been listening to what Robin had to say there. I'll ask both of them for their thoughts on our call. We're going to take a break for news. On the other side, get to more of your calls and your questions as well. And close to the top of the hour, a quick newsmaker segment on this agreement that was reached at the state capitol for the compensation fund for the 35W bridge collapse victims. Short little segment on that as well near the top of the hour. But to the newsroom and Greta Cunningham. Hi, Greta.
Good morning, Carrie. Thanks. The unemployment rate has dropped to 5% after employers cut far fewer jobs in April than had been expected. However, the economy still lost jobs for 4 months in a row, and the latest numbers reveal strains in the labor market. But the news is encouraging enough to send stocks higher this morning. Federal regulators are planning tighter rules on credit card companies. The government wants to prevent the companies from unfairly hiking interest rates. It also wants to make sure people have enough time to pay their bills. The Olympic torch relay has ended in Hong Kong without any disruptions. The flame was carried through the city today by 120 runners. China's recent crackdown on Tibet inspired torch relay protests in Paris, London, and San Francisco. In regional news, as Carrie mentioned, Minnesota House and Senate negotiators are outlining a deal to reporters this hour that will compensate victims of the Interstate 35W bridge collapse. Lead Senate negotiator Ron Latz confirmed that a deal was reached last night. The $38 million plan would allow victims to get up to $400,000 each, and there's a supplemental $12.6 million fund for the most severely injured. Latz says those who agree to the payments from the funds will also have to agree not to sue the state for damages. He thinks the bill will pass and that Governor Plenty will sign it into law. The August 1st bridge collapse in Minneapolis killed 13 people and injured 145 others. Retired U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor is in Minneapolis today speaking about the partisan and political nature of judicial elections. She's speaking at a luncheon hosted by Minnesotans for Impartial Courts, the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance, and the League of Women Voters in Minnesota. There's a wind advisory in effect this afternoon through this evening for northwestern and west central Minnesota. A chance of showers around the region. Some locally heavy rain is possible today, with highs from 47 in the north to 65 in the southeast. At this hour, some light rain is falling in Moorhead, a temperature of 40 degrees. It's overcast in Rochester and 55. Duluth reports some light rain and 36 degrees. And in the Twin Cities at this hour, overcast skies with a temperature of 47 degrees.
Minnesota Public Radio is approaching the end of another budget year. And as you consider all the compelling stories you've heard, please remember how important Minnesota Public Radio is in your life. Your support makes it all possible. Help us meet our budget year-end goals. Contribute today by mail, by phone, or online. Go to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org or call 1-800-227-2811 and you'll automatically be entered to win a $1,000 Amazon gift certificate. No contribution necessary to enter.
Programming is supported by Summit Brewing Company in St. Paul, avid supporters of local arts, music, and the obscure activities that bring friends together. You can find out more at thesocialelement.com.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Leif Enger is going to be in the studio with us. You remember his best-selling book, Peace Like a River, out with a new book that's an adventure story. It's like a road trip into the Old West. And Leif is going to be in the studio to talk to us about it. And then Monday at 10, a copy of the Declaration of Independence that was created right after the original work was signed in 1776 will be on display here in Minnesota as we celebrate our sesquicentennial. And we're going to talk about the story behind that copy. And we'll talk with two renowned historians about the story behind the Declaration and how the Declaration lives on in modern America. Should be a good conversation. Joseph Ellis is one of our guests for that. And that's Monday at 10. Back to our discussion this hour, we're talking about an article that Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote for the Atlantic Monthly, the May edition. It's called This Is How We Lost to the White Man, The Audacity of Bill Cosby's Black Conservatism. By the way, you can find a link to that article and to Ta-Nehisi Coates' blog on the Mid-Morning page at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. And John McWhorter joins us this morning. He's a fellow with the Manhattan Institute, author of the book Winning the Race. John, good to have you back on the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
I know you listened in to what Robin had to say, and I want your thoughts about that, where she was saying working with people that she considers to be broken, this is a rather harsh message for them.
Well, actually, the nature of things is such that I actually only heard the tail end of what she said.
All right.
But what I can contribute is simply this. From what I heard, what she was saying was certainly true. But what we need to keep in mind is a very simple fact. It has two short parts, and this is it. The main problem facing Black America today is not racism. And here's the second part. The main problem facing Black America today is not institutional racism, societal racism, white privilege, inequity, or the system. Those are the two things that I think are really at stake here. And those are the things that make what Bill Cosby is saying controversial. Those are the things that make anything that I've ever said controversial. Now, the issue is not that there is something tragically wrong with Black people. It's not that something hideous went wrong about 30 years ago. It's a matter of character, and that we need to slap Black people in the face and tell them to shape up. That's not what's going on at all. What's going on in our community is something different. Unfortunately, it's rather complex. It's more complex than white people not liking Black people, and more importantly, it is more complex than something called societal racism. And the main issue that is facing us today is that somebody like Cosby, and nobody can say that Cosby's not really Black. Nobody can say that Cosby doesn't care. Cosby, unlike me, is not employed by a conservative think tank. And mm-hmm. So he's got all of his bona fides in place. What Cosby is saying is that the problems now are no longer about something someone's doing to us. We have misguidedly ended up in certain positions because we have come to expect that all of our problems must be because of somebody else, and that therefore the main thing we need to talk about is what somebody else needs to do. Now, of course, everybody in the black community says that change has to come from within. I don't know anybody who would say, if you ask them, do you think that our change has to come from within? Are we responsible for our own fate? Nobody would say no. But to the extent that there is this impulse to say, but the main thing we need to be talking about is, and then fill in the blank, that's the problem. Because, no, we don't need to be talking about the main thing. The main thing, if the main thing is what the government needs to do in terms of turning completely upside down, what we really need to do is talk about how America was founded upon slavery. What we really need to do is talk about how people with names like Dwayne and Tamika still don't get their job applications picked up as quickly as people with names like Justin and Caitlin. No, we don't need to talk about those things. And the reason is because we can talk about those things until our faces turn blue, but it won't change anything for the black poor.
Let me read something that you wrote, and I want to bring Ta-Nehisi Coates back into our discussion here. You wrote this shortly after Cosby's pound cake speech in 2004. Too many blacks stopped keeping their eyes on the prize, but it certainly wasn't because whites became more racist. The idea that we can only achieve under perfect conditions is a disabling fiction. Ta-Nehisi, weigh in on that.
I think I would just respond by saying, I don't know how to do an either or ranking. I think I agree with John that it's much more complicated than societal racism, but it's also much more complicated than not naming your kids Shaquilla and pulling up your pants. I think, you know, as I said before, you can walk and chew gum at the same time. I think you can have institutional critiques, but I don't think institutional critiques excuse personal responsibility. I think you need to have, I think they're, you know, for instance, I have demands that I put on the school for my son. That doesn't mean when my son comes home, I don't demand certain things from him also.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you agree with John McWhorter.
I do.
After having described yourself as a leaning left kind of guy, I'm a little surprised about that. John, go ahead.
Well, you know, that's just the thing. I'm often considered this fire-breathing, controversial, conservative person. And yet, anything I say, just about anything I say, is something that I think most black people in their homes agree with. I'm really not that conservative. And Ta-Nehisi, I have great respect for what you do. I don't think people should stop giving their children names such as yours. That wasn't my point. My point was simply that talking about the fact that there is a study that shows that having a name like that might give you some infinitesimally less chance of getting a job as a lawyer, I don't think it's something that's worthy of extended discussion, because we need to talk about how to help the black poor, how to help ex-cons get jobs, and things like that. But I just worry, very briefly, that if we say that it's a two-way street, that we have to hold people accountable, even though we might also have a conversation about societal racism, what worries me is that if that's true, then why are people so angry at Cosby? Because Cosby is talking about the responsibility, and suddenly that's quote-unquote controversial. I don't think it should be controversial at all. I think we should just be listening to him as, you know, our personal Jeremiah Wright. It seems that sometimes, and I don't mean this as I don't mean this as a slam. I have a severe, snotty voice. It's my handicap. It's why I prefer to write. But when people talk about how it's a two-way street, it seems like too many people really would rather talk about societal racism than about what we can do to help ourselves. And the problem is that societal racism alone is something that's always going to be there. If we're going to keep talking about societal racism, too many people are going to stay suffering. It has to come from within, and we have to get used to talking about it.
Let me go back to our listeners here. Quickly online from Lisa in St. Paul, isn't this about class within the black community? Middle-class blacks distancing themselves from poor blacks. Is that right, John?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
No. We have to stop talking about that as well. I mean, the idea that the black middle class are somehow wrong to want to live in big houses and to not want to live in ghettos, let's try it this way. We could have a long philosophical discussion over whether that's fair. And after we had had that long, agonizing discussion, middle class people would still be wanting to live in nice houses away from the ghetto. We have to choose our battles. And I think, really, if you look at the middle class black community, it's actually pretty common that black people have a sense of solidarity. Look, for example, at how a year ago black people were saying they weren't sure whether they were going to vote for Barack Obama. That was what one was supposed to say. Now, almost every black person to a man, I mean a very large percentage, are going for Barack Obama because there is a sense of mutual identity. In the same way, I don't think that most middle-class black people look at the black poor as laggards. you know, it's not 50 years ago where people would say, oh, well, that lowly person who doesn't work. Everybody knows that society isn't fair. And so we need to have a new kind of dialogue about how we can work the system so that people who are left behind can make the best of themselves. And at the Manhattan Institute, I'm actually seeing people do that every day. Manhattan Institute has a big tent, and it is not about, you know, right-wing causes like being anti-abortion and anti-gay. That's not what the Manhattan Institute is. I'm not doing a plug for it. But what the Manhattan Institute is about is, for one thing, helping poor people not to be poor. And so the idea that the black middle class has left black poor people behind has a certain theatrical resonance.
But you don't buy it.
I don't buy it, and whatever is wrong in that case is not going to change. Let's stop pointing fingers, and let's start helping people help themselves.
Let me go back to the phones to Laura in Garrison. Laura, thanks very much for waiting. Your question, your comment for us.
Hi. My home is actually in Atlanta. There has recently been a large controversy going on there because Judge Marvin Arrington, who is black and grew up in the projects just a short distance from where his courtroom now is, threw all the white people out of the courtroom recently
right. And
lectured all the black people and said, I'm sick of the parade of black defendants. I am tired of this culture. You know, I'm tired of what is happening in front of my eyes every day. And he was roundly criticized for throwing out the white people. And his response to that was, I grew up in an age when you did not air your dirty laundry in public, and I think that that's what Bill Cosby was trying to do when he addressed the NAACP. He was trying to air his dirty laundry in front of his friends and his colleagues and the audience that needed to hear what he felt he needed to say. And now Cosby is coming to Atlanta, and he and Arrington are going to do the call out together.
Is that right?
And yes. And what you should know is that Marvin Arrington is a very highly respected black man who is respected by both blacks and whites. And, you know, this issue is very personal to me because my children are both adopted and they are biracial, white and black. And they're just getting to the point where they're old enough to realize that their skin's not the same color as mine. And I'm trying to figure out who I can point to in my community, which is largely composed of hip-hop moguls with regard to role models for black people and a huge amount of black-on-black violence in Atlanta. Who I can point to besides people like Marvin Arrington who are taking the black community to task and saying, wake up, you're creating part of the problem.
Laura, stand by for a second while I ask Ta-Nehisi Coates for some thoughts on what you've said.
Well, the first thing I'd say is that, and you know, I think this sort of dovetails with some of the point John was making, is it's, I think we overstate how different what Cosby is saying from what ordinary black folks, and I hate that word ordinary, sorry about that, what rank and file black folks say. I mean, I really want to restate this again. Cosby's approval rating in the black community is 85%. The only person who's higher is Oprah Winfrey. So, I mean, I don't know how much, I mean, I guess it's taking the task, but I think there are plenty of black folks who are standing around, you know, waiting to be taken to task. As for role models, I think this has to be the best point ever, especially if your kids are biracial, to be looking for a role model when you have a black man running for president, who I think is doing both of those things. So I think is talking about personal responsibility and at the same time also offering some institutional critique and for some things that we can do. So I think it's out there. I mean, I think if you want to look to hip-hop stars, then you can look to hip-hop stars, but I think there are plenty of black folks out there who are doing the right thing who can also be looked to for role models too. I think, you know, if you want to cut on the TV or you want to cut on the radio and look for role models, then that's probably a problem in and of itself.
And John McWhorter, the last word on this.
Yeah, I'm going to do something I've never done before very quickly because I'm genuinely curious. Right now, there's some people who are thinking, oh, John McWhorter is not the, you know, idiot that I thought he was. I want to say this. Ta-Nehisi, why was your piece on Bill Cosby so sour, given what you're saying now?
Huh.
I didn't think it was particularly sour.
You mean the current one or the one that he wrote in 04?
The one in the Atlantic is very, very wary of Bill Cosby. Yeah, very wary. Yeah, very, very circling, very carefully. Sour. And I'm just wondering, given that you seem to really agree with what he was saying, I'm genuinely wondering what creates your wariness about him?
I'm wary of people who, again, as I say, offer personal critique, who say, you know, personal responsibility should be stated in lieu of an institutional critique. I don't understand why both can't be done at the same time. I should also add, and I mean no disrespect in saying this, it's Ta-Nehisi.
Oh, it's not Heasy?
No, it's Heasy. I know it looks like
Heasy.
Okay, I'll remember that.
John,
do that all the time. It's completely okay.
John, a closing comment here because we've got to go to our newsmaker segment.
That was my closing comment. I think this is an ending. This is an unending discussion, and I guess my closing comment would just be that, yes, it goes both ways, but that can't be code for the most interesting thing to talk about is societal racism, because that will always be there.
Are you working on a new book?
I have two coming out. One's about hip-hop. One is about the history of the English language, and I'm very tired.
Well, come back and talk to us about them. They sound interesting, all right?
Love to.
John McWhorter is a fellow with the Manhattan Institute, author of the book Winning the Race, and as you've heard, working on two others. John McWhorter, thank you. Ta-Nehisi Coates, thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us. I hope you'll come back. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, and his article is titled, This is How We Lost to the White Man, the Audacity of Bill Cosby's Black Conservatism. We're going to turn now to a developing story at the state capitol, where lawmakers have just finished a press conference announcing details of an agreement that's been reached about the 35W Bridge Collapse Compensation Fund. The agreement comes after weeks of differences in negotiations between the House and Senate, and Tim Pugmire has been following the story. He was at the press conference this morning. He joins us from the state capitol. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here, Carrie.
It's a $38 million package. How much does that mean that each victim may receive, and how will they decide who gets what?
Well, here's how it breaks down. There's actually going to be two pots of money. There will be a $24 million fund for individual claims, and each individual claim will be capped at $400,000. There will be a supplemental fund of $12.6 million. And this will be intended for those folks who had the most extraordinary circumstances, the highest medical costs, and the most, as far as uncompensated medical costs and wage losses from the victims, those who actually lost their lives on the bridge.
Does it mean, in essence, then, Tim, that the people who take these settlements— they also agree not to sue the state, but that the state is also admitting to a certain amount of liability in the bridge collapse?
Well, that is definitely the case, that the folks who take advantage of this fund are agreeing not to sue the state. But in terms of the authors of the bill, Senator Ron Latz and Representative Ryan Winkler, say this in no way is an admission of any fault by the state. We should also mention that the awards will be determined by a three-person panel, a special master panel, it's being called, that the state Supreme Court will appoint. We'll see those people in place by June 30th under this agreement.
And are these people likely to be judges, Tim, that will make these decisions?
That's unclear, but clearly they're going to look for people in a position similar to a judge, people who will be well-respected and their opinions accepted by the victims as they work through all these claims, which could take until February 28th of 2009. That will be the deadline. That will be the deadline for this panel to come up with settlement offers to all the survivors and families of the victims.
How close did they come to not being able to reach an agreement?
Well, surprisingly, as much time has been spent on this, after the bills were passed in the House and Senate, they really came to a deadlock over trying to reach a final a deal here because of the differences in the two bills. You'll remember the House bill was a $40 million shared fund with no individual caps at all. The Senate passed a bill that was a $26 million package and had caps at $400,000, which is the state liability limit under current law. And the Senate was very firm in keeping that cap in place, and they did win out on that point. This supplemental fund that's been created eases concerns in the House that some individual awards won't be sufficient to take care of some of these extraordinary costs. Considering it's only 9 months after the collapse, the long-term health costs to some of these folks is still an unknown at this point.
Yeah, is there a sense then, or is it hard to know, if the victims will be satisfied with this? I know some of them are represented by attorney Chris Messerly, and he, from what I understand, knew about where they were headed here with this deal. But do we know whether everybody will be satisfied with this?
Well, there are a lot of people that will have to make that decision, but we were able to talk briefly to a couple of folks. Jennifer Holmes, you'll remember, lost her husband Patrick in the bridge collapse. She was on hand for this news conference today, and she said she was happy and thrilled with the result, and she definitely plans to take advantage of this avenue, has no intention of filing or pursuing a lawsuit against the state.
Yeah, Tim, a quick question here. Senator McCain has gotten in some hot water about comments that he made on the floor of the Senate about the reason that the bridge collapsed. He said it was because of pork barrel spending. I understand Governor Pawlenty was trying to reach him to talk to him about it. Do you know whether there's been a conversation?
I have not heard that yet. I've been out of the loop here, focused on this news conference across the street. And we do have a statement from the governor that came out this morning in regard to this agreement. And Governor Pawlenty said he looks forward to signing this legislation in law. And he says it provides needed relief and support for victims and family members directly impacted by the bridge tragedy.
All right. Tim, we thank you for your time.
Good to be with you, Carrie.
Governor Pawlenty again saying that he plans on signing the legislation. This is an agreement that was reached overnight at the state capitol between House and Senate negotiators on a victims' compensation fund for the 35W bridge collapse. Coming up in just a few minutes, Leif Enger is going to be with us. He's a former Minnesota Public Radio reporter who went on to write a best-selling book, Peace Like a River. That was a while ago. Now he's out with his latest novel, So Brave, Young, and Handsome. What an adventure story. You can tell Leif Enger really admires and loves stories from the Old West. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about how, over the course of these 6 or 7 years, he's been conceptualizing this novel and what he's been doing in between. Leif Enger, in the studio with us, by the way, speaks at Barnes & Noble in Edina tonight at 7:30. So listen to our conversation. If you'd like to hear him read some excerpts and talk about the book tonight, you can do that at Barnes & Noble in Edina at 7:30. On Monday morning at 10 o'clock, you've probably been hearing some of the stories here on Minnesota Public Radio about Minnesota's sesquicentennial. We are going to talk about the fact that this copy of the Declaration of Independence, and I've been doing some reading about this, it is so interesting what happened with the original copy of the Declaration of Independence and a number of the copies that were made. They were not treated, believe it or not, as very extraordinary documents for a number of years. We are having one of the copies that was made after the original was signed in 1776 here on display in Minnesota in celebration of the sesquicentennial. There's an interesting story behind that copy. And two renowned historians are going to be with us to talk about how the Declaration lives on in modern America. One of them is going to tell us that it was really Abraham Lincoln who brought the American citizenry back to the idea, back to the argument that's at the center of the Declaration of Independence. So all of that on the agenda on Monday at 10 o'clock. Let me mention, you've probably heard that our conversation that was planned at the Fitzgerald Theater with Cokie Roberts on May 22nd has been postponed. She had a news assignment, well, that she couldn't get out of, and so she can't make it to Minnesota in late May. We're working to reschedule that. She's promised us a rain check. I'll let you know as soon as we've got that set. But let me mention, we've got other events going on at the Fitz, and talking volumes on May 27th, Michael Ondaatje is going to be at the Fitz with us. We're going to talk about, of course, the novel that he's probably best known for, The English Patient, that went on to be made into a movie. But he's got a new terrific book out called Divisadero, and he'll be here at the Fitz to talk about it. I hope you'll be in the audience. This is Mid-Morning.